Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Sandy Clark, and in this episode, I'm joined by Professor Alvin Ng, one of Malaysia's leading voices in mental health, to talk about the importance of mental health literacy. Alvin is an Associate Dean for the School of Medical and Life Sciences at Sunway University, and he was the founding president of the Malaysian Society of Clinical Psychology. Among his research interests are mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, cross-cultural aspects of mental health intervention, and mental health literacy. Alvin is well known on social media for sharing insightful thoughts on the many advantages of improving mental health literacy, and I began our conversation by asking him what mental health literacy means and why it's so important.
To me, mental health literacy basically means how much you know about mental health. Firstly, what mental health is, how is it different from mental illness? What are some of the factors that contribute to mental well-being and also factors that contribute to mental illness? What you can do about it? I mean, what can you do to maintain good mental health? And if you are mentally unhealthy, what are some of the things that you can do? Who are the people you can seek out for help? Where can you go? What sort of resources can you look for online or anywhere else to find out more about what mental well-being, mental health, mental illnesses are? And well, basically, where to get help. Just like how if you are physically ill, most of us know more or less what to do. You know, we have our grandfather, grandmother stories that we hear of and what you can do to take care of yourself to address any form of illness. Or you could go to the doctor, to the hospital to go get yourself checked out. So when it comes to health literacy, we more or less know what to do. We even know signs and symptoms of what COVID is. But when it comes to mental health and mental illness, somehow most of us don't quite know exactly what to do or what it means. So that's mental health literacy in a nutshell. Quite a big nut, though.
So it's kind of, it's becoming aware and sort of educating ourselves on, you know, what to look out for and then what kind of services, support are available. And then to sort of almost normalize that in the same way that we would go and see a doctor for physical health needs. And I think as well, at the moment, there is more conversation on mental health literacy. You know, with people like yourself being at the forefront in Malaysia, sort of driving that conversation. But we also see a sort of worrying trend whereby, for example, on some social media platforms, there is a sort of troubling rate of misinformation, misconceptions, sort of harmful information that people might buy into and believe. What are some of the common misconceptions or myths about mental health that you frequently encounter over the years as a sort of clinical psychologist by trade and as a sort of university lecturer as well?
What I can think of now is biggest misconception, I would say, is confusing the term mental health and mental illness. Too often, I find people using the term mental health when they actually mean mental illness. For example, sometimes when I bring up the topic of mental health and that, you know, it's good to have conversations about mental health and, you know, to have talks so that people have better mental health literacy, I get the response from some people saying, oh, no, I got no mental health. You know, I'm fine. It's okay. That's where I help to improve your mental health literacy by saying, oh, so if you don't have mental health, you must have mental illness. And they go, oh, no, I don't have that either. So health and illness are two very different things. And yet when you put the word mental in front of it, people just get confused between the two. So I suppose therein lies the stigma of the word mental. That kind of contributes to the misconception that mental health is the same as mental illness. I mean, anything mental is bad. So a big, big misconception that mostly maintains a stigma of the word mental. And I think the second most common misconception about mental health, mental illness, is that as soon as you get diagnosed, your world ends. It's something that is a huge, huge no-no. It's as though it's a life sentence that if you get diagnosed, for example, with major depression, you are a mental patient, you are a psychiatric patient, and that's it. You know, your whole life is gone. Nobody wants to employ you. And we know that that is absolutely untrue. Tons of people who have got psychiatric diagnosis whom you would not even know have psychiatric diagnosis. Yeah. Functioning well in society. Some are even leaders of organizations. They are going through treatment and, you know, treatment with regards to medication. And they also have got psychotherapy that helps them manage themselves on a day-to-day basis to help them function. So yeah, I think if you to ask me what are the two biggest misconceptions, those are the two. I mean, there are more, of course, but I think these are the things that I would want to usually bring up first.
Important point you raise when you talk about leaders in mental health and psychology who have had issues with their mental health. I don't know if many listeners will know the names offhand, but for example, Marsha Linehan, the founder of DBT, she has a sort of, she openly speaks about her struggles with mental illness past. Stephen Hayes, who created acceptance and commitment therapy, that started because off the back of a sort of panic disorder that he struggled with for years, similar with his co-developer Kelly Wilson. He talks about his issues as well. So I think that is such an important point to raise, that whether you have mental health issues or an actual mental illness, you know, there is treatment available. It can be effective, and quite often people do function quite highly while they're dealing with and getting treatment for any issues that they do face. And I'm wondering, because one of the things that you're quite well known for is to sort of highlight these kind of points through social media, through the talks that you give. And I'm wondering whether in general, you know, you have any tips about how people can enhance their mental health literacy. And maybe a second part to that question would be, what can communities such as universities, organizations and so on, what can they do as well to foster mental health literacy?
One is, of course, to read more about mental health, to speak to mental health professionals. And one thing I would like to really add that I think many people don't think about is to also speak to people with lived experience. So what I mean by people with lived experience are people who actually have a psychiatric diagnosis and talk about how they go through treatment, how they manage themselves, and what they think mental health literacy is or should be. And to, I suppose it's to normalize again the whole idea of mental health, and that, you know, just like physical health or even dental health, there's treatment. Whenever there's any kind of problems or illness, and treatments can work, although sometimes treatment don't work. Same thing with physical health. You know, you go for second opinions and things like that. But the main point is, unless you ask for help, you're not likely to get it. And we know that there's a high correlation between asking for help and getting help. So there's no need for stigma. And I feel that the more we talk about the management of mental health, the more normalized it gets, and bringing people with lived experience into the picture also helps normalize their lives. And to see that when it comes to a picture of mental health, each time we see some media posts, either in mass media or social media, when it comes to having a picture that denotes mental health or mental illness, you usually have someone looking like they're depressed. Even the term mental health is associated with something like that, which I think needs to change, because, you know, there's no such thing as a depressed face. We get depressed now and then, but we don't necessarily look depressed.
Coming back to that point you made about physical health, it's tying in with that, you know, not all physical health issues are visible or obvious as well. So this idea, maybe that's one of the misconceptions as well, that mental health issues, mental illness, has a particular look, has a particular presentation. Whereas, you know, we both know, for example, people with depression, people with anxiety disorders, they can be seen to function in their sort of daily lives and just, you know, perform their work, have engagements, but they're kind of struggling underneath. And like you say, it's so important to have those conversations and just check in with people, you know, ask questions, try to find out information. And it kind of leads nicely into my next question, which is, when we increase our mental health literacy, how does that help, or does it help in terms of distinguishing genuine mental health services and support from, say, pseudoscience or quack services? And of course, without naming any names, I think we can think of a couple of examples where people might encounter certain services, certain individuals, whereby they can't distinguish at this point in time sort of pseudoscientific service from genuine services. And I'm just wondering, from your point of view, if we can increase our mental health literacy, you know, in what ways does that help make that distinction?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point, because just like physical health literacy, you know exactly who to go to when it comes to, you know, going for an assessment for your physical health. With mental health also, if you're literate about mental health, then you're more likely to know the differences between a psychiatrist, clinical psychologist, a counseling psychologist, a counselor, a psychiatric occupational therapist, a community mental health nurse, psychiatric social worker, mental health social worker. You know that these people are trained in managing mental health issues and that you can go to them for help. Literacy would involve knowing who the professionals are, how they train, where they can get training, and the kinds of competencies they should have given their qualification. Because, you know, mental health, the whole topic is such a mysterious one, people tend to not know, or even when they start finding out, they have difficulties telling people apart. So I suppose it's more the need for exposure from legit professionals, that they come out and talk and also talk about the kinds of competencies they have and don't have. Like, for example, I'm trained as a clinical psychologist. There's no way I can see every single problem in the world, because there's only so much training I have. And the professional thing to do to let people know my range of competencies. And that's something that, you know, medical doctors, medical specialists do. You know, if you're a cardiologist, you don't treat people for other problems. You may know some things about other problems, but when it comes to the actual treatment, you would refer them on to another specialist. And the lay public knows that. I mean, if you get a cardiologist talking to you about your brain, you probably want to think twice and go and see someone else. Same thing with a mental health professional. As part of mental health literacy, we need to get savvy about who these professionals are, how they are trained, what kind of problems they are able to address, whether they are trained more towards assessments or treatment. For example, some clinical psychologists don't do very much treatment at all. They do mostly assessments, whereas some don't do assessments and some do basically just therapy. So it's something that the public needs to know when it comes to asking questions, you know, what they're able to do, rather than assuming that they can do everything, which is not a case.
Yeah, and I really like that point you mentioned about being open about your areas of specialization and areas of interest. And because sometimes you see these, again, pseudoscientific services that offer a sort of shopping list of...
And they say they can do everything.
Yeah.
Treat everything under the sun. Even if your dog's depressed, we can do that too. You know, that kind of stuff.
So I think that's one of the red flags to look out for, right? I mean, coming back...
Absolutely.
Increasing literacy. You know, if you have any health practitioner, mental health practitioner who says, for example, you know, I can work on any problem, brief therapy and we'll cure your problem. All you have to do is take these kind of supplements, take these kind of medications and you'll be cured. I think looking out for information like that is really important. I mean, like you say, you're trained in certain things and there's no way to know about every problem. And for example, as a counselor, I make this point that I specialize mostly in grief, maybe anxiety, but I don't make mention that, you know, I have these other 12 areas of specialization, right? Because I know that there's a particular scope of knowledge, of competence, and if meet with a client who I recognize, look, I don't have the knowledge to provide the services for this person, then I would know to refer out and, you know, send them to someone who can give them effective treatment. But I think what catches people off as well is that as soon as they see, for example, PhD or master's qualification or whatever, they assume that that person is, you know, expert on everything. And some individuals do give that impression. I think that's a really important red flag to sort of bring up. But again, if we talk about mental health literacy, coming back to what you mentioned earlier about reducing stigma, I get the impression that one of the reasons why people sort of recoil from discussions about mental health and mental illness is because of a fear. You know, they don't really understand or know what it is that they're discussing. And so, you know, there's this sense of, oh, it's a terrible thing. If you have something wrong with you, it's going to be forever. It's going to be permanent. It's untreatable. You'll be ostracized and so on. So I'm wondering, again, from your point of view, when you increase your mental health literacy, how does that help someone in terms of reducing the stigma that they might carry?
I think it can empower a person to continue having conversations about mental health. Even as a psychologist, I would say that, you know, right from the beginning, I myself had stigma, self-stigma as well as stigma of others. But the more I find out about what mental health and mental illnesses are, speaking to people with lived experience, going through mental health help myself, helps to empower me to just be curious about the subject and to explore in a way that, you know, I don't allow my own prejudices to blind me to other people's experiences. And I think that's a very liberating kind of feeling where I can just openly tell people, yeah, as a psychologist, I also see other psychologists, because that's what psychologists are trained to do. And I'm confident that they can help me. If they don't, I'll go find somebody else. And, you know, I still get the questions like, Alvin, you're a psychologist. Why do you need to see another psychologist? And my usual answer is, have you seen a dentist drilling their own teeth? So mental health is just like dental health. If you need help, you go to a professional. And that's very okay. And the next question, aren't you afraid that people laugh at you? See, they laugh at me, good for them. You know, I'm seeking help because it's for me. I care about my well-being. I care about my physical and mental well-being. So I go see a professional to work on it, because that's the goal. But if you attach a stigma and you attach shame to that goal, then how are you ever going to reach it? Plus, I show people, I like to use myself as an example, because I'm also a leader in a field, is to show people that, look, I still have friends. I still am able to do what I do. I can do things well, partly because of getting help. You know, it's not a one-man show. We are a community and we help each other out. Sometimes we need professional help and that's fine.
Yeah, it's interesting when people have that reaction, right? Like, you know, you're a psychologist and you see a therapist or a clinical psychologist and, you know, they have that surprise. And I've had a similar reaction. I mean, I've been having therapy for the past 2.5 years ongoing. And to me, it's just, it's good practice for therapists to have their own therapist, right? Because it helps you see certain blind spots. It helps you to deal with your own issues as well. I think there's a very sort of well-worn phrase by this point, but I think it points to a truth that, you know, psychologists, therapists, and so on, they're just as human as anybody else. So just because you've got a master's or a PhD in a certain field doesn't sort of strip the humanity from you. You're still susceptible to life struggles, setbacks, stresses, and events. So I think that's another thing that you do really well is to be very open about, you know, well, yeah, I see psychologists sometimes, you know, that there are struggles sometimes. And I think it does highlight this idea that, look, life isn't always sort of on the up and up, right? That there are setbacks, there are challenges, there are periods of struggle that we all sort of deal with, and having this avenue to seek help is something that's beneficial and nothing to be afraid of in that sense.
Yeah, I like to use dental health and I guess you can call it an analogy. It sounds like it rhymes with mental as well, isn't it? So dental health is like mental health. You can brush your teeth all you want, thinking that you'll avoid the dentist, but eventually you're bound to see the dentist for all kinds of stuff, like scaling and things like that. Minor things, because, you know, brushing can only do so much.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that idea that you can help yourself, but only to a point if you are struggling. I mean, I think that there is a range of things people can do as preventative measures. And again, you talk mm-hmm. about that quite a lot as well. Things like exercise, things like sort of slowing down, you know, engaging in hobbies, interests, socializing with people, all this kind of stuff that factors into overall good mental health. But like you say, at some point, you know, we are going to come up against things like spells of anxiety where it's quite overwhelming, maybe self-grief through personal loss of some kind. Mm-hmm. I mean, we both subscribe to maybe some Buddhist philosophy. So there's this mm-hmm. idea that, you know, at least degrees of life are going to be rooted in suffering. And so when we get to the point, what mm-hmm. do we do to sort of help ourselves? Well, we can do a lot to help ourselves, mm-hmm. but then we might need an extra hand along the way.
Yeah, it can be fun too. The more the merrier. Yeah. And if you can have a sense of community that's supportive of you, that's even better. So that's where we have sometimes group therapy. I've seen two professionals at the same time before in the same room. You know, you've got two heads instead of one to help look at blind spots. Mm. That can be fun.
It can also be a sort of cathartic process in the sense that whether you're in individual therapy or you're in group counseling, there's this sense of, you know, you're being seen and understood and heard, and nobody's trying to sort of, you know, change you into being someone that you're not. And, you know, they give you a bit of a reflection to help you understand yourself and your issues more clearly. Mm-hmm. I think, as I've said to some clients before, and as they've said to me on a couple of occasions, how often is it that you can sit in a room with people or a one-to-one session mm-hmm. where you get the time to express yourself without someone offering solution, offering advice, trying to say, you know, just move past it, just get on with it, it's fine. Mm. There's a real sense of, I don't know if liberation is too strong of a word, but there's a sense of just, wow, okay, so I can have this time, this space just to explore this thing, whatever's happening. And through that, you can then understand whatever's going on and hopefully take steps to then deal with it quite effectively. I don't know if that's been your experience as well.
Oh, yeah. And knowing that these are professionals who are trained, these are the competencies, and I can trust that process. Mm. And I can be myself, be open, be vulnerable, and it's a safe space.
Mm. I think that's a really important point as well, because maybe part of the fear or the worry is that if you go to see a mental health therapist or psychologist, then, you know, is my boss going to find out? Is my family going to find out? Is my, you know, wife, husband, whatever, are they going to find out? Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's an important part of it as well, this idea that it's private and confidential, that, mm-hmm. you know, with the exception of a few circumstances that the therapist mm-hmm. discussed with you at mm-hmm. the start of the session, everything that's said and done in session stays in session. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite an empowering thing as well, right? That you mm-hmm. can go into a space and have that trust and have that sort of space and place to really talk whatever's on your mind, speak whatever's mm-hmm. on your mind, and just share to another yep. person.
Yeah, I would go further and say, you know, if you're afraid about your boss finding out, bring your boss along. You know, trash things out. Who knows? You know, you might get support. Of course, don't just do that. But I mean, my point is basically to feel comfortable enough to even share with whoever who's significant to you and to go together. Again, for me, the more the merrier. I think these days I work more as a system, as a community, rather than as an individual. Because at the end of the day, it's about that sense of support. The reason why people are afraid to tell anyone is because they feel as though if they were to tell anyone, they would be rejected. And that's a huge no-no, being rejected by society. But if you can be proud of what you do and to help others see why you're proud of it and why it is helpful, then wouldn't that be something that's more empowering, more comfortable, where you're able to tell, for example, I'm able to tell my boss, look, I'm having an off day. You know, I'm not functioning. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to make an appointment with a psychologist soon. And he's able to say, yeah, great, wonderful. Good to hear that you're taking care of yourself. And my colleagues know it's a small world. So it's nothing to be ashamed of. And because they know, they're better able to provide me with support. Mm. And if we can all be at that stage, I think we can beat the stigma that way. That, you know, there's no need to dramatize. You know, I haven't had people go, oh, yo, Alvin, oh my goodness, really, you're seeing a psychologist? Oh no, are you okay? And they become oversensitive. Yeah, I would imagine some people getting that way, but generally people don't. And I'm a firm believer of behavioral experiments. Experiment and see. Get out there and get talking to people and see what happens. Would people actually reject you? And if they do, does it matter? For all you know, they don't quite matter to you anyway, those who reject you. Plus, even if they do matter, then at least now you know that they are not the kind of people you want to be friends with, maybe. It helps you screen. And from my experience, it's been very positive. Telling people that I seek help has never lost me friends. In fact, my being open and vulnerable, and I suppose I like to use the word raw, I find that people can appreciate me more because I've got nothing to hide and they can trust me that way. I see it as a strength. And I suppose that's where I find it very empowering to be who I am and to be accepted.
As you were talking there was two things that came to mind, which I think is really quite helpful to highlight in terms of, you know, this idea of mental health literacy and what would that mean. The first being that I think one misconception is that if you seek help, then it's a weakness. Whereas I think it's been well demonstrated by this point that actually going for help is a source of, or an indication of strength and courage. One of the best sort of pieces of advice, I suppose, that I received when I was younger came from my grandfather, who came through the Great Depression of the 1930s and was part of the silent generation, so-called. And he was in the Second World War and all that stuff. And I remember him saying that people would say that crying, if men cry, for example, then that's a weakness, he said, but actually it's a strength to show your emotions. And he added that the real weakness is kind of hiding from what you're feeling, hiding from what you're needing to confront. Maybe it's not a weakness to hide what you're feeling, because maybe there's something there that's making it too uncomfortable to share at that point. But still, his point stands, right? There's nothing weak in showing or that you need help, that seeking for that help. Actually, it's a sign that you're taking the initiative to take care of your well-being. And the second thing that came up as you were talking was, and I've certainly seen this in the way that you've spoken on social media and the way that you interact with people, in the sense that it kind of gives permission to people and it allows people to actually open up about their own issues, their own struggles, to have those kind of conversations. That if someone like you, who's a leader in the field, who's quite a prominent voice in mental health, when you can speak so openly about, you know, your experiences, then there's this sense of, oh, right, okay, so yeah, I'm feeling exactly the same as well. And, you know, maybe someone else's friend chips in as well. I've been feeling similar feelings, experiences as well. So it kind of allows for that sharing of conversations, and again, coming back to this word of normalizing helps behaviors.
I also like to use the Avengers / Justice League analogy. I mean, look at these superhero movies. I think they've gained traction because these are superheroes coming out and asking for help. Unlike the typical superhero movies of before, where it's a one-man show, one-woman show, they actually come out and they ask for help. And they work together as a team to support each other. And every now and then, they have their conflicts. And I like that because it shows that even as superheroes, you're not perfect. You'll have conflicts. But there are things you can do to resolve those conflicts.
There's always ways around conflict. There's always ways to sort of support each other, complement each other. Maybe someone is struggling and other people can rally around. And then, you know, if you're struggling at some points, hopefully other people can rally around as well. And there's a real sort of dose of humanity in these kind of superhero movies, right? Like the Avengers and so on. And you get these kind of flawed characters. Just as an aside note, I think I remember reading some time ago about how when Superman was first conceived, he was flawless and, you know, impervious to any kind of weakness. And I think that there was some feedback along the lines of, look, you can't really sell this because people won't buy into it. He needs to have some kind of flaws in order to be relatable to some degree. And as soon as that started to manifest, then people took to the character. And so there's something quite resonant about these superheroes, about celebrities, for example, or whoever you might look up to. One of the examples that comes to mind in terms of celebrity is the singer Louis Capaldi, who has been very open about his struggles with Tourette's syndrome. And there's a wonderful clip on YouTube. He was struggling on stage at a major festival in the UK. I think it was last year. It's called the Glastonbury Festival. And in the middle of one of his songs, he started to have an episode, and the crowd sort of took over and sang the song for him. And he just stood there and looked out. And the amount of support that came his way afterwards was just so inspiring. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, people like yourself, and you have your celebrities and even the superheroes kind of showing that, look, this is part of normal life. This is part of our human experience. And you know, there's no need to hide from it. But maybe just to wrap up with a final question, Alvin, it's been a really enjoyable conversation so far, but just to get your thoughts on, you mentioned earlier that maybe some years ago you had your own sense of stigma, your own sense of self-stigma when it came to mental health or mental illness as well. What kind of positive outcomes or changes have you observed over the years that result from increased mental health literacy, both from yourself as an individual and maybe from the wider community? So as mental health literacy improves, what have you kind of noticed within yourself, within the people around you?
First thing is you have more conversations around mental health and mental illness. People are more open to wanting to find out. The amount of curiosity has increased, and I think it's a positive kind of curiosity, especially among the youth. Teenagers are amazingly literate when it comes to mental health. This is my experience so far, because I've been dealing with teenagers just recently, giving training and stuff, and the kinds of questions they ask about mental health is very, I mean, it shows that they've been doing readings about it and they're curious and they want to find out more what they can do themselves. So I think curiosity is one. Secondly, the curiosity leads to a sense of wanting to feel empowered about it, wanting to speak more about mental health issues and to create an environment that's able to help. So I see compassion. I see compassion in the youth in wanting to bring up issues and to do something about it. That's the kind of thing I'm seeing. And it shows, I think, in the community where we are having more and more groups focusing on mental health issues, and they are organizing talks, workshops. These are just random groups, or they join organizations. We have got lots of corporate organizations also looking into mental health issues, having a change of labels when it comes to executives. You have got now people managers, or I don't know, the people person of the company, that kind of thing. More, I suppose, community oriented rather than like work oriented. Some HR departments have relabeled themselves as something else instead of just human resource. No, we are not resource, we are people, that kind of thing. And there's lots of mental health ambassadors, wellness ambassadors, if they don't want to talk about mental health. So I think that sort of movement is very healthy, and I'm encouraged to see all that. So I've covered like teenagers up to corporate organizations. We are seeing that. We're also seeing governments also focusing more budget on mental health here and there, although it's still very, very little, but it's encouraging to hear more focus.
And I think through the work of Relate Malaysia, there have been certain policymakers or politicians who have been quite generous in terms of giving their time and help and helping spread the importance of mental health literacy and highlighting certain issues. And maybe just on one final point, Alvin, as listeners are hopefully enjoying this conversation, what kind of advice would you give, if someone was sitting listening to this and thinking, well, I'd like to sort of find out more about, mental health awareness. I want to increase my sort of knowledge and understanding of what you guys have been talking about. Where do I start? Like, what should I do in terms of increasing my sense of awareness and understanding?
Best would be to speak to someone who's experienced in mental health. So, of course, mental health professionals would be one. Mental health academics, like myself at a university. People with lived experience. Start talking to friends about mental health and see what comes up. You might find friends who say, oh, yeah, I see this counselor. And, oh, really? So what's that about? And start exploring other people's experiences. And what's really important is to reflect on what has changed in you with regards to understanding more about mental health, and focus on that change and keep on exploring. I mean, that's been my experience so far. That's been my journey. It's quite humbling as a mental health professional to learn more and more, and to know that there's lots to learn. People say that I'm an expert, but I don't feel like an expert. So much to know about mental health and mental illness, and just carry on being curious. I think curiosity is a very good thing.
As you mentioned, maybe even as an expert, there's no way you can know everything there is about the sort of complexity of mental health, mental illness, but it's just that idea of being curious about what you want to learn about. So maybe how to manage stress, or how to manage anxiety, or maybe something that were severe, or you want to have a conversation. I think it's really important you mentioned having conversation with people who have lived experience, because we can read the books, we can attend the webinars, but there's nothing quite like having a conversation with someone who has been through something like depression or anxiety disorder, or maybe some personality issue. And to get the sense that, well, actually, even though this person might struggle in a certain way, it doesn't detract from who they are. And it doesn't mean that they can't function, or they can't hold a conversation, or be engaged in activities. So I think just having that conversation really sort of disabuses people of certain misconceptions that they might understandably hold. So I think that's a really key point to end on as well. So thanks very much for your time, Alvin. It's always a pleasure to have a conversation. And, hopefully we can catch up again soon. There'll be plenty of other topics in future to talk about, I'm sure. But thanks very much for your time and insights on this topic.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, Sandy.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.